Welcome to the BFM Historical Society. This week, we talk to Bill Curtin, one-time production manager and also program director during a boom time here at BFM. Bill remembers that period, including being the voice of irreverent newsreader Vaz Deferens. Welcome to the BFM Historical Society, Bill Curtin.
Good evening. Well, I came from a commercial radio background, and I'd temper that by saying when I first started in FM radio in 1984, when I was a 16-year-old, straight out of Whangarei Boys High School, it was a bit of a different beast to the lame corpse you see before you today on the airwaves around New Zealand and the world. So I'd had probably 9 years of commercial radio before I came to BFM. I'd spent time in provincial radio up in Whangarei in Hamilton and thereabouts, and then at the end of the 80s I went to the UK, optimistically hoping I might get into radio over there, which was a completely retarded thing to hope. But blow me down, I did get a job as a afternoon DJ at a radio station in Belfast in Northern Ireland, where I worked for a couple of years. For some reason, I think it was the weather, I quit that job and I came back home to New Zealand and couldn't get a job anywhere in radio, but decided I'd settle in Auckland. So I followed my best mate Dallas's lead and joined the staff at Country Chicken, delivering fresh and frozen goods around Auckland City, and that's where I stayed for some months. One day, and I remember it clearly, we were in the lunchroom there at Country Chicken, and one of my colleagues put a little newspaper clipping in front of me which said that they were looking for a production manager at 95BFM student station. And I had a look at that and thought, well, what the hell? Came up to BFM, walked through the door and was ignored by Cindy Manor and a few other people for a good 5 minutes. And then I came in and had my interview, but I knew straight away this is where I wanted to be. They hired me ahead of the incredibly gifted Chris Vandergeer, who should have got the job, really. But that's been the story of my life, you know, lucky accidents. I didn't even know how to do the job, but I wanted that job so bad that I said that I, you know, could probably pull it together. And they hired me. I think Harriet Crampton, the station manager at the time, probably was looking for somebody with some kind of commercial experience to get into that job, and I guess I wasn't too much of a knob, but I suspect I may have been wearing boat shoes when I came up for my interview. But I got the job ahead of Chris. Maybe they thought it was post-modern fashion. The lovely Eddie Chambers was really patient with me and helped me through those first few weeks. I got the hang of it slowly but surely, running the desk with the help of Bob Kerrigan and other people around at that time, and made ads for a couple of years and had a real blast doing it. So I did that job for a couple of years. Really creative people and a lot of time to make these adverts, and of course they ended up Bob Kerrigan and Scott Kelly ended up winning a whole bunch of awards and all sorts of things. Bob will get a swell head, but he could do, you know, he just come up with stuff that you just would never dream of, you know. Very, very clever guy. Let's play The Breeders, a song called Saints. I would play The Pixies, but I notice a lot of other people have chosen The Pixies. The Pixies were a real favourite of mine back when I was in Hamilton, and I was turned on to them by a friend, Simon Haynes, who was at Contact, the student station there. I ended up interviewing Black Francis in Belfast there with Kim Deal sweating next to me. So I've gone for a song from Kim Deal from The Breeders, and that's called Saints.
Do I?
would have been about 1995. Graham Hill, who was the program director, elected to leave, or I think from memory he did. And they were looking for a new program director, and Harriet Crampton, the station manager, again approached me and said, would I be interested in that job? And I was quite taken aback by that, but I said, yeah, I'd love to do that job. And she said, well, you'll have to apply for it. And so I applied for it, and I expected, once again, Jupp Davery, the maestro, who was the guy, you know, on the with the ear to the street, would get that job ahead of me. But again, I got the job that I think should have been for someone else. So he was very gracious about it, and I did that job for 4 years, I think it was, all up. The first 6 months, at least, I was at BFM. I was terrified someone would find out that I wasn't cool, and I'm not, and I never have been. But yeah, so I got that job, and it was a real tough job to take over from Graham, because Graham was BFM in a lot of ways. You know, he just knew everything, knew how to do everything, knew everybody, knew what to do. So to take over from him was a really daunting task. But yeah, somehow I took it on. But eventually, I sort of got into a groove, and I guess everybody has some sort of a mandate, something they want to do, because it's such a huge job. And I wanted to do all sorts of things myself. I didn't know what they were to begin with, but I took all the cues I could from all the people around me. For example, the first thing I did was get those 1200s. They wanted that, so we got those installed. Mm. And I did various things. I moved the wire from 10 until midday till 2, because I figured it was clashing with national radio. So I moved that, and I guess we made a few specialer shows as well, and tried to put my spin on stuff, but at the same time keeping it the way it is. Graham left and did breakfast for a while, and then it came to a point where Graham left and the board said to me, if Graham was to go, would you have a replacement for him? And I knew who that person was straight away. It was Mikey Havoc, who I thought was the strongest DJ we had for a run of station DJ on the station at that time. He was doing two Friday drives a week, and I think his TV show was about to kick off, or had kicked off at that time, I can't remember. But we put Mikey on the breakfast show because, you know, the old radio adage that win breakfast, win the day is true. We stuck him on breakfast, and there was a little bit of consternation from some quarters, nothing too major, but not everybody was happy with that decision. But we put Mike on breakfast, and the station blew up, really, in 6 months. We didn't know it at the time, but I found out the numbers later on. The first 6 months Mike was on, we had a spike in the numbers that almost doubled our 10-plus audience, which is massive. And it was simply because it wasn't just down to Mike, it wasn't down to me, it was down to a whole bunch of things. I think it was a real confluence of things coming together at that time. We had Mikey, we had all this new music that really no one was playing, all this, you know, whatever you want to call it, Smashing Pumpkins, Cypress Hill, whatever, that whole Lollapalooza, the whole thing, you know, we just started playing all that and people started listening. And I think at that time as well, we had the Big Day Out starting. We had some tremendous on-air talent. We had the commercials were sounding amazing. This station was the greatest station in the world right then. I mean, it has been before and it has been since, but you know what I mean? It was a big time there.
Yeah.
And the numbers reflected that later on. And so that particular period, I think what really explains how popular it became was shortly after that, everybody came to town. You had The Edge, you had The Rock, you had Channel Z starting up, you had 96.1. They all came to town because they figured if these assholes with their, you know, student station can do those numbers, and it was over 4%, which doesn't sound a lot, but that's what Hauraki does on a good day. They figured, well, if they can do it, let's get in there and let's do some of that too. They all failed, I think, ultimately. But I remember when Channel Z started up, they had this dreadful advertising campaign where they had some guy who was not just pulling his earring out, he was pulling his ear off and eating it. And it was so bad and so dated. And the board were kind of worried about that station starting up and stealing our thunder. But God bless him, Ross Goodwin, the program director, the first song they played was In Excess. Or was it the B-52s? And I knew right then there was nothing to worry about. Let's play a song. This will be no surprise to anybody who knows me. This next track. This is to me one of those muscular songs that I think BFM does so well. No one else would play it, but what a great band. Mudhoney, Touch Me, I'm Sick. I think from memory I had been to the established New Zealand Music Awards at somewhere or other. I really can't remember, but I remember going to the New Zealand Music Awards and it was Dave Dobbin again and Neil Finn again and the same, God bless them, and that's really neat, you know, but it was the same people again and again. And I sat there thinking there's this whole other world that you guys are not even touching on. They didn't even know who Sheherd was, who were massive at the time, or Head Like a Hole, or any of these really popular groups. They weren't necessarily underground either. They were really big groups playing to big crowds, but completely ignored by the New Zealand Music Awards. So I came away from that kind of deflated, and the very next day we had a staff meeting and I just said to everybody, we've got to have our own music awards. It was a no-brainer, and of course everybody said, yeah, why don't we do that? And we did, and the first one was held at the Mandalay. It went so well that it really quickly became an industry fixture, and the entire music industry would be there come hell or high water, no excuses. Now you see the regular New Zealand Music Awards definitely include a lot more kind of emerging artists. I might have inherited the New Zealand Music Month or the New Zealand Music Week from Graham Hill, I guess. More than likely Graham pioneered the New Zealand, you know, the live to air bands that you know, like the Headless Chickens and Straight Jacket Fits that were just so fantastic. But I thought we could just do a whole lot more, and during New Zealand Music Week we would have live bands down at the recording studios in Shortland Street playing up here, and we had just a whole bunch of groups coming in and playing, and that was really exciting. And we also were broadcasting live from the Big Day Out every year. That was a lot of fun, because that was our concert really, wasn't it?
It wasn't all smooth sailing. Every now and again someone on air would be naughty.
Yeah, you know, but those are often the best moments when someone does that. I think it was Nick Dwyer, whose flatmate recorded this VJ on the Juice or one of those TV stations, he'd forgotten to turn the microphone off. And so while this video was playing, he was saying, "If this, see that, Daniel Wright's in this, Daniel Wright's in that," for a long time. And I'm pretty sure it was Nick's flatmate who recorded that. And of course, Nick played that on the radio the very next day. And I had to go in and sort of pretend to tell him off because, you know, but, you know, at the same time, I thought it was hilarious.
Yeah.
And so things like that happen just all the time. And you can't you can't discourage it, and you can't encourage it either.
Yeah.
I used to like to see what people would get up to, because you have that total freedom here, you know. When Mikey Havoc won Best New Broadcaster at the New Zealand Radio Awards shortly after, maybe a year or two after starting on Breakfast here, he got up in front of the assembled throng of commercial radio people and said, "Isn't it amazing? We've all got a frequency that we can do whatever we like with." And absolute silence. No one knew what the hell he was talking about. They didn't get it at all. I used to encourage the DJs not to swear on the radio, and I think it's a bad idea, because as soon as you do that, you are cutting out maybe 25-30% of your listening audience who just don't listen if they're worried about their kids hearing the language. For example, I won't play BFM in the car on the way to dropping my three kids off at school in case they hear swear words.
Even now?
Even now, man. And my oldest one is 10. I mean, they can handle it. They've heard those words, but I just choose not to. And then I drop them off, and then of course I turn it right on there. But I used to come down quite hard on that, and I used to like the DJs to play the playlist as well. That was one thing that I was guilty of, I guess, when I started and took over from Graham, is that I wanted to have more cohesion. I wanted BFM to broaden out a little bit more with its playlist and its sound outside of the specialist shows, and make some hay out of that territory, because you can. And I felt that some DJs could be self-indulgent to the point of disappearing up their own ass because they're playing stuff that no one really wants to hear. There was a guy who was a great guy and a great DJ who insisted on starting his show every week with about a 10-minute long bell ringing thing. And I said to him, "Man, you just can't play that because I don't want to hear it, and neither does anyone else." And he said, "It's my trademark." And I said, "I don't care." And he refused, so I took him off and put someone else on there. And, you know, maybe I was a little bit hard like that. I figured that BFM had a maximum reach of, I don't know, 5%, 4% of the entire 100% of available radio listeners at the time. I figured if we could just push that out to where that should naturally be, then why not, you know? That way you can get more advertisers, do more exciting things with marketing and promotions, and, you know, get the word out there. So I didn't apologize for that.
No.
I knew what I wanted BFM to be, and I wanted to put it right on that line, you know. This next song is sort of before my time, but it's Public Enemy, and I think it's another example of a great muscular song that BFM can play and no one else has the balls to play, and it sounds good every time.
Of a TV station, but look around, here go the sound of a record ball, boom and pound. When I shut them down, I shut them down.
Shut them down.
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 Shut them down.
I shut them down.
Shut them down.
Shut them down.
I shut them down.
Shut them down.
Shut them down.
I shut them down.
Shut them down.
Shut them down.
I shut them down.
Shut them down.
Shut them down.
Shut them down.
One, two, three, four.
Civil liberty, I can't see the pay of feet. I never saw a way to pass out to read the law. Then become a victim of a lawyer. The lawyer never saw it. Take cues, getting me sued, playing games with my head. What the judge said, put me in the red. Got me thinking about a trigger to the lead. No, no, my educated mind say suckers gonna pay anyway. There's gonna be a day, cause the truth they roll in. I posse up home from the ground, ready to go. Throw another round, sick of the ride. It's suicide for the other side of town. When I find a way to shut them down, I shut them down. I shut them down.
I wait for respect, check one, hit the deck. Let the man of the hour commit the soul power. For once I got to say shut them down on a regular, cause a mass hysteria in your area. Kicking it for my man Chuck D, Del P.E. on the remix. Hun, hold the flick, so check it before I step down when I'm in your town. You know I got to shut them down.
Who count the money in the neighborhood? But we spending money to no end. Looking for a friend in a war to the core. Ripping up the poor in the stores until they get a brother kicking down doors. Then I figure I can get bigger. Look them dead in the eye and they wince. The fence is pressurized. They don't really want it to be another racial attack in disguise. So give some money back. I like Nike, but wait a minute. The neighborhood supports, so put some money in it. A corporation zone, they gotta give up the dough to my town or else we gotta shut them down. I 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 shut them down.
How can you improve on Public Enemy? Well, Pete Rock and Seal Smooth and improve that song for me. And I remember that song being played at a party at my huge house that we had in Grafton that had a swimming pool. And I remember Marcus Lush was there wearing his Y fronts and a pair of cowboy boots on a skateboard with a cowboy hat. And we've got a photo of that somewhere, which I'll find one day.
Bill, during your time as PD here, quite a lot of really amazing local acts came through, and you were always diligent for, like, you know, strange things would turn up and there'd be an odd demo and you'd just go listen to it. Oh my God, you've got to listen to this. Throw it on the playlist straight away and just get really excited. And I think one local artist that was particularly huge who came out of a bedroom at that time was Darcy Clay.
That's right. Yeah, Daniel Bolton, we still miss him. As a program director, you know, for music, I think the way that I preferred to do it was to take all my cues from everybody else. So Stinky Jim would give me a tune and say, this is going to be huge. I would take his word for it. I would put it on the playlist right there, and you would do that yourself. Everybody would feed me, and I would be the conduit, and we would put it on air, and it always worked. When it came to demos, it was the same thing again, and someone gave me, I think Daniel actually, Darcy came up to BFM and gave it to Bob Kerrigan, I think, and said, this is my song that I did at home. Bob must have given it to me. We stuck it on the radio, and I remember walking along Jervoice Road, hearing it on my little Walkman cassette radio, hearing it on the radio on that big fat 95 frequency, and just thinking, this is amazing. This is such a great song. You always thought that you'd heard it before. You always thought that it was a cover, but it wasn't. He just wrote it. And now it's sort of entered the lexicon, I guess. It's become one of those songs that people know all around the country, and, you know, you'll hear it on the radio at a party and you'll turn it up. That was a good example of one of our songs that was huge and that no one else had the balls to play. That's still where BFM has the advantage, because commercial radio stations never have the balls to jump on something straight away, you know, that they never, ever, ever do, and not that I can recall, from the Sex Pistols right through. They always last, and that's the key advantage BFM has, is that BFM is still in touch with the kids, what the kids are listening to. The kids are here. There's a guy out there right now with one blue sneaker on and one red sneaker on, and his pants are probably the wrong way around, and he's the guy that should be here, and he's here, and that's great, and I love that. With some respect to commercial radio programmers, if they screw up on a regular basis and program the wrong songs and no one listens, then they lose their job. Was it BFM? You can screw up, and I mean, I put on some horrific choices, and I'll tell you, Jupp Davery will otherwise. I playlisted Alanis Morissette.
Wow.
To begin with, when I was brand new, I learned very quickly.
Can you remember who it was that brought that artist to your attention?
No, I can't remember. It would have been from the record company. That was when I was fresh and I didn't know how to say no. So one of the great things about being a program director here is you can throw shit at the wall and see if it sticks, and that happens with, you know, a lot of artists. And one of the groups that was a real BFM fixture was, of course, Voom, who I was lucky enough to play drums for a little while, and that was a really great time. They recorded this song right after I left, and I think it's Buzz Moller is just such an incredible singer-songwriter. And this is one of his finest, and one of the finest New Zealand songs ever.
A show called The Friday Night Allen, which was hosted by Bob and Scott, the creative team here at BFM, and you were a weekly contributor to a segment on that show.
Was it The Friday Night Allen, or was it The Drive Show? Did they replay it on Friday Night Allen? I think that vast difference. Yeah. Hugh was doing Friday Drive at the time and doing an incredible job at the same time, And we had this little character called Vass Deferens, who was a newsreader. And he would come in and read the news at 5 o'clock. And he's modelled on Larry Williams off News Talk ZB. Interestingly, he used to be a policeman. But I noticed that Larry Williams and a lot of DJs do that in between sentences. They'll say, it's coming up 3:27. Like that, and that's sort of how it started. And Bob Kerrigan and Ben Hill and Scott Kelly would write the script, and it would be very offensive and ridiculous, and I would be presented with it right before I went on air, and the challenge was to not laugh, and I often couldn't get through the segment without laughing. But yeah, that was amusing to some, I guess. Well, I think we may have got Broadcasting Standards Authority wraps over the knuckles for those, because there was some pretty offensive stuff on there, like things we said about Winston Peters, and McDonald's was another one with the McShit, and so on and so on. So yeah, they were a bit on the nose. Another thing that Hugh used to do as well, which was slightly alarming but very, very amusing, was we found that there was an accountant's or a lawyer's office in Auckland called Cox Arcus. Two different words, Cox Arcus and Company. And of course, when you rang them up, the lady would answer, and she'd say, good afternoon, Cox Arcus and Company. And it sounded like, you know, so, but Hugh turned that into a feature, and he would even promo it and say, don't forget, you know, at 5:15, right after Vass Deferens, we're going to be ringing Cox Arcus for our weekly phone call there. And, you know, they'd answer the phone and we'd laugh, and that would be the end of it. But we did that for weeks and weeks, and they've changed their name.
Probably very sensibly.
I tried to ring them the other day, just to see. About 1999, I went to the UK to get married to my lovely wife, Fiona, who I've been married to for 10 years now. And when I came back, I had sort of been disestablished, and that's, you know, that's the way it is here. Yeah, so I graduated and found myself unemployed, which was fine, yeah. So after that, I built a house. And then I was rung by my good friend Dave Yetton from Stereobus, JPS. Dave said that they were looking for an engineer at Sky TV for audio post-production, and would I like to have a crack at that? So I did that for about 6 months. And then I got a phone call from Mike Havoc and Jeremy Wells and the executive producer for TV2, asking would I like to direct the Havoc show with no experience.
Again. Directing a TV show. I'm sure I can do that.
As usual, I was thrilled to do that job. And Paul Casserly had left, and they needed a new director, so I was that guy. And I saw them through from halfway through 2000 Deluxe right through to the very end of the Havoc and Newsboy TV shows. So that gave me my start in television. Mm-hmm. Here's a song that I found and the hardest job is trying to get 6 songs, but this one is one that everybody knows, and I guess it's indicative of a whole period, and it's The Orb, Little Fluffy Clouds.
Over the past few years, to the traditional sounds of an English summer, the drone of lawnmowers, the smack of leather on willow, has been added a new noise.
What were the skies like when you were young?
They went on forever. We lived in Arizona, and the skies always had little fluffy clouds in them, and they were long and clear. There were lots of stars at night. And when it would rain, they were beautiful, the most beautiful skies, as a matter of fact. The sunsets were purple and red and yellow and on fire. The clouds would catch the colors everywhere. That's neat, because I used to look at them all the time when I was little. You don't see that. Arizona, the skies always had little fluffy clouds in them, and they were long and clear, and there were lots of stars at night. And when it would rain, it would all turn. They were beautiful, the most beautiful skies, as a matter of fact. The sunsets were purple and red and yellow and on fire, and the clouds would catch the colors everywhere. That's it, neat, because I used to look at them all the time. You don't see that. You might still see them in the desert.
When you've done the Havoc show, just like when you've done BFM, I think you might be pigeonholed as a certain type of person. So I wanted to do more TV stuff, but there was a bit of a hiatus there while my career sort of restarted. After the last series of Havoc that was on TV3, the one that Mike did on his own, and I got a phone call from my old friend Aaron Carson, who was station manager here at BFM at the time, and he said, "What about it? Come back as program director." And I thought long and hard about that. And in the end, I made the decision that I would, because I'd had such a great time here. You know, it was the best job I've ever had, and I wouldn't have missed it for the world. So I thought, what the hell? I've got nothing to do. I've got a mortgage to pay. I've got kids. I'll go back there. And I came back and was program director for about just under a year, I think. Must have been 2004,
right.
Three, four, I can't remember. But I found the same beast here with a lot of familiar faces and a whole bunch of new faces. Reinserted myself back into the system. And no, who was doing breakfast? Was it Hugh? No, Hugh left just after I started.
So this was Camilla.
That's right. That's right. I gave after long and hard thought with Aaron. I thought, let's go for someone young, someone completely different, someone like nobody else, and I chose Camilla to do that job to some opposition. I thought that she had something. When you're looking for somebody to do that job in particular, or a high profile job, you've got to look for someone that has an X factor. And generally, I've found the people with the X factor are the people who will do what they want and walk away from it when they want and don't care. And they're all the same. Mikey is the same. Marcus is the same. Hugh is the same. Paul Holmes is the same. Aaron Carson told me once that Paul Holmes rang him and said that he'd driven his brand new Nissan straight through the back wall of his garage. You know, the people with the X factor appear the same to me, and I think I know what they look like, and I will always choose that person over someone else for a profile job like that. So that's what I did. It was weird coming back, but the board wanted me to come back. I think they thought that I had some magic clues to how to get BFM back up to where it was once upon a time when I was here. I mean, I can't take the credit for the popularity BFM had at that time. It was just a happy accident of all these things while no one was watching. So I think that the board, having tasted that success, have always wanted to get back there. And fair play to them. I don't think it'll ever happen again, but maybe it will. And I think that they wanted me to come back and maybe lift BFM back up somewhere again, because it appeared to be maybe a little too low in the numbers, because by that stage, BFM was buying the ratings book, which is a bit of a double-edged sword. When you buy those ratings, I guess it's like filming yourself having sex. Maybe you might suffer from performance anxiety ever after, and maybe it's never the same again. to come up with an appropriate analogy, I think BFM is still where it should be. You know, it's occupying that ground that no one else can really occupy.
What happened next for you?
After I left BFM, I had a real good offer on the table from Greenstone Pictures, where I still work, to make a show called Neighbours at War. And so I did that. I've just finished the fourth series that's gone to air. And I did that for about 4 years. I've done a lot of other stuff as well in television, but that's been my mainstay, the Havoc stuff and the Neighbours at War stuff, for my sins.
Thanks for coming in. This year, of course, BFM celebrates its 40th anniversary, which I think is an amazing achievement for this radio station and the way it kind of runs and stuff like that. Just a few thoughts from you on how you think BFM has managed to get this far, and also what you think it needs to do to stay strong and shine into the future.
Well, you know, I think that BFM is, you know, I've heard people say it's the music. At the end of the day, it is the music. And that's true, but hey tangata, hey tangata, hey tangata, it's the people. You know, it's the people that make this place and everything that brings. And it's, you know, it is an exclusive club, and it's not the right place for some people. But the people, they're still here, you know, they're still here. And I guess as long as they retain the frequency and the ability to broadcast here, then it'll go on and on and on, because you can't really take that away, because there would be a lot of us strapping ourselves to that bulldozer if they ever tried to shut it down. I'd also say, you know, keep the board and the management on their toes, because they don't know what they're doing either. A lot of the time, no one really does. So, you know, they've done some great things and maybe some things that weren't so great. So everybody needs to, you know, keep watching each other and pushing it forward together. And I'd say, you know, play the hits. Don't forget, don't be scared to play the hits, man. I know that was my watchword when I was here, but you know, you can make so much hay out of that, and we're all still listening, and it's not an exam, you know. There's this tablet, and you pick it up and you add to it and take stuff away from it, but it's the same thing. It's the same thing that carries on. I don't know what that is, but it's good.
What's the last one?
Is Mercury Rev.
Okay, are we still rolling?
Yep.
I guess this next song is no surprise to a lot of people that know me as well. This was one of my favourite songs. We interviewed the guys from Mercury Rev on the Havoc show. They were assholes, but I still love them and I still love their music. And this is a real BFM song that we own. This is Holes by Mercury Rev.
Just born between jealous spies. Got telephones for eyes. Come to you as friends. All those endless ends that can't be tied.
Have been listening to the BFM Historical Society, a radio documentary series made to commemorate BFM's 40th anniversary.